This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with journalist and author Jeremy Scahill.
Jeremy has been looking at the recent appointments by the Obama administration and questioning whether this is really a president that is going to bring us real change.
We'll also talk with New York attorney Jonathan Heifetz, who will give us an update on the Ali Mari case.
He's waiting to hear from the Supreme Court. Will it look at whether the president has the authority to take people in the United States and throw them into a prison, denying them all legal rights? An important case. Stay with us.
Michael, I saw you on my computer debating last week. You're down at Georgetown University at the law school there, debating Stuart Taylor on the question of whether or not there should be prosecutions of the war criminals or something lesser. I just kept shaking my head thinking, Stuart Taylor, he's certainly no Telford Taylor. Telford Taylor was a great American attorney, chief prosecutor at Nuremberg, a totally principled man. His namesake, Stuart Taylor, didn't quite measure up to the standards of Telford Taylor. When you pressed forward the argument for prosecution, he had all sorts of different reasons on why that shouldn't happen, although I think you were forceful enough to eventually get him to concede that there should be some kind of quiet looking into the whole question. But there's a big debate going on now. A lot of editorials, a lot of talk, I think a lot of fear about whether the war criminals in the Bush administration should be prosecuted or left off the hook. What's your feeling on how we're going to get this done?
Well, you know, Michael, at the Center for Constitutional Rights for a number of years now, we've been trying to get accountability for the torture scandal, the torture program. We've brought civil suits here. We've tried to prosecute Rumsfeld abroad, et cetera, et cetera. So now that we're going into a new administration, there's tremendous fear within the old administration, and particularly the torture conspirators who are made up of Cheney, Rumsfeld, Tenet, CIA, Bush, as well as a set of lawyers, Addington, you, Gonzalez. And their fears, which they've had all along, as to whether they'd be prosecuted or not. So now what you're seeing is just an onslaught, really an onslaught, of conservative and sometimes even liberal pundits and others saying it's a bad idea to prosecute, don't prosecute, it's going to hurt our national security to do it, you're looking backward, not forward. And these are some of the issues that I debated Stuart, what I call Stuart Pardon Taylor, because he wants pardons for these guys.
Yeah, but the law is absolutely clear. It's absolute. Torture is illegal. It's illegal under international law, which we've adopted domestically, and it's illegal under domestic law. It's absolutely clear. And it's not a question we don't know who did this. We also know who did it.
But right now is actually a key moment, I think that's right, where this debate is going on. And the center is weighing in saying this is not a time for, quote, truth commissions even. People, I mean, the right, of course, conservatives don't even want a truth commission. But this is a time for a special prosecutor to be appointed to do an criminal investigation of what I call the torture conspirators. This is not a time for, you know, half measures or political efficacy. This is a time for a criminal prosecution, and at worst, a criminal investigation at least, or a commission of inquiry that will result in a criminal prosecution. But even some liberals are saying, well, we can't get it, so why try for it? You know, it's the old Frederick Douglass statement. You never get anywhere without a demand.
You never did, and you never will.
And so you have to demand what's right here, and what's right here is a criminal investigation. In that context, of course, I had the debate with Stuart Taylor, in which he's basically trying to minimize that even waterboarding is torture. And it's a debate that people can, as you said, see online. But I also want to say something about Michael Mukasey, who's our attorney general, and who recently gave a speech at the Federalist Society. And at the Federalist Society, he gave it – a Federalist Society is a conservative – legal organization where many of the government officials have come out in the last while. In fact, you sort of had to be a member to get to be appointed to a judge or an official of the government. But Mukasey, as people know, collapsed while he was, or may not know, but last week he collapsed while he was giving a speech to the Federalist Society. And what he was saying, it actually relates exactly to this issue of prosecution. Everybody's getting frightened, including him. And he's the attorney general. Mukasey said just before he collapsed, and I quote, "And I am hopeful that sometime from now, after the next administration has had the chance to review the decisions made and the legal advice provided, it will acknowledge that despite any policy differences, the national security lawyers in this administration acted professionally and in good faith, and that the country was safer as a result." he said, quote, as a result, three times, and then he fell over. So you're hearing in that quote three excuses. One is that it was a policy difference, that the question of whether you torture people is a policy difference, when in fact, of course, it's against the law. Secondly, you're hearing that they acted in good faith. Well, you know, Pinochet would have said he acted in good faith when he tortured people in the name of national security. And I think it's a jury question. It's not a question for pundits.
I'm willing to grant their sincerity. We've never been yet able to invent a sincerometer. We'll grant them their sincerity. It's a question of breaking the law.
Right, and it's a question for the jury. If a jury hears, well, this is the legal advice I got, this is why we did it, and they believe that in good faith they had a right to give those opinions, a jury could acquit them. But that's very unlikely.
Well, I've read the opinions. So have you, Michael. Those opinions are just tortured logic.
Right.
They're ridiculous legal arguments.
I called them garbage on my debate with Stuart Taylor.
We'll put that debate up on lawanddisorder.org.
Even Taylor couldn't accept the U opinion that the president was above the law, essentially.
No.
Even he couldn't accept that. Anyway, the third thing McKenzie said, of course, is the country was safer as a result. Well, first of all, they got very little, if anything, from torturing people. If you read the books carefully, most of the information they got was way before they tortured people. So the torture almost seems, as you and I have discussed in the program, Michael, as an act of vengeance. But the great thing that also happened to the Federalists, you have McKenzie giving this speech about not prosecuting people, collapsing on the stage. He's apparently going to be all right, although, you know, he did run in a marathon on Long Island with me last year. I didn't know he was in the race. I'm not sure he'll be ready to do that again.
I'm sorry you didn't know. You might have tripped over it.
Right. So, but the other thing that happened at the Federalist Society, remember, these are very conservative judges or very conservative lawyers. Some of them apparently are principled, because one of them, a judge from Seattle or something, Judge Sanders, started yelling during McKenzie's speech. This is the Federalist Society, started yelling, "Tyrant, tyrant, tyrant."
Really?
In the middle of McKenzie's speech. This is amazing. This is a conservative at the Federalist Society when McKenzie is giving his talk about not prosecuting people. This judge, a state court judge in Seattle, I think, is yelling tyrant. And, of course, what does it remind you of? It reminds you of Julius Caesar in Rome when Julius Caesar is killed by Brutus, and Brutus yells when he's plunging the knife into Caesar, "Thus ever to tyrants, thus ever to tyrants." You know, we're getting some dissent in the country, but this issue, and I want people to be aware that what we insist on here, what we absolutely insist on here, is that there be criminal investigations and prosecutions of the torture conspirators.
That there be accountability. And I think the reason is that if there's no accountability for this, they then lowered the bar in this country to a place where civilized society should never go.
Let me say a word about accountability. Now, one of the arguments I hear from the anti-investigation prosecution people is that this is looking backwards. You know, Obama will ban it going forward. Yes, he'll ban the CIA from torture. Yes, yes, yes. He'll conceivably do all of that very positive stuff. But what I say to them is what you had here was an administration that no matter how many laws Obama gets passed, no matter how many executive orders, these people and people like them are capable of twisting the law in a way, and it's completely unacceptable, but they'll do it. And secondly, what happened here was an assault on law itself. This was not just about twisting the law. This was about law itself. And unless you have prosecutions going forward, you're going to have it again. If you have all the laws in the world, the next guy is saying, well, the president can torture in the name of national security. So it's not actually going backward. It's going forward to bring prosecutions.
And moreover, putting these people in prison is a deterrent to future acts like this.
Well,
that's really what I'm saying. Criminal law.
That's what I'm saying.
Otherwise, you should open the doors and let all the murderers
out of
prison.
It's not looking back. It's not looking back. It's looking forward.
Exactly,
it's a deterrent. Right. And it works for every shoplifter. Why doesn't it work for torturers?
Michael, let's talk a moment about Guantanamo, because we had Obama saying during the course of his campaign that if elected, he would close Guantanamo. He's still saying that. We're not sure how soon or how quick he's going to do it. But there's also talk about there's 258 people left there now, and there's talk about bringing them back to the United States, possibly trying them in criminal courts, possibly trying them in some kind of special national security court. There's this whole discussion going on, maybe just keeping them here in preventive detention. What's your thoughts on that?
You know, Obama has, and we have to give credit for, just as he said he would stop the torture program, he said he would close Guantanamo, and I actually believe that he'll close Guantanamo. I don't think we're going to again see an offshore prison at Guantanamo, at least not for a very long time. But the real question is, how does he close Guantanamo? And of course, we at the center have a particular position on that. Of the 250 people left there, we actually believe they should all be, every person, repatriated back to a country. And if they can be tried in those countries, fine, but not to countries where they'll be tortured. And it should just be closed. At 7 years, it's long enough. What's coming out and what could also be a position is, look, send back the 230 or 240 people that are simply wrongly picked up. And of the 5 or 10 who the U.S. government claims might be involved in terrorism, our position is, if you're going to do that, bring criminal charges and try them in U.S. federal courts. That's really the position here. Either repatriate them all or repatriate 95% of them and try the other ones in federal court. That's the clear position. That's what ought to happen.
And federal courts have provisions. If there are national security problems, there's a law in place that takes care of those. So why not try them in federal courts? What are the bad guys saying against that argument?
You know, there's a study made by Human Rights First of 120 terrorism cases since the year 2000. 120 tried in federal court, almost everyone with classified information, and everybody says it was completely, you know, successful. It wasn't – this is not an issue. There's a special act, as you said, Classified Information Procedures Act. You can use classified information. What you're hearing really – and I think it's just an excuse – what you're hearing is some of these people, we don't have enough evidence to try, and really for two reasons. Really, one is because of they've been tortured, and the only evidence they claim they have is torture evidence. I want to say I don't think that's the case. I think in a lot of these cases, some of the so-called 9/11 people they claim gave confessions on video before they were even captured. So I don't think that's the only evidence they have. I think it's a red herring to try and bring us another legal regime. And the other one you hear, of course, is classified information, which is obviously a complete red herring. So what these people are suggesting, and occasionally they quote a liberal on this too, is they're suggesting that we need what's called a preventive detention scheme in the United States. And what that means, that's their word. Preventive. My word would be you want to hold people without charges and trial. That's what they're saying. So they're saying because we can't try some people, we want to hold them without charges and trial. Even those preventive detention scheme, we want those reviewed in a special national security court. And my answer to that is, first of all, this is completely unnecessary. What you're doing is taking a few people, and we don't even know the truth of what the government's saying, taking a few people who they claim they can't try, and they want to set up an entire legal scheme that we've never actually had in this country. We've had it with Guantanamo, because Guantanamo is a large preventive detention scheme, but it's not a lawful one. So what you see some transition people saying, and I'm not saying Obama's saying this, I'm not saying it's not just being floated by some people out there who want to try and get a preventive detention scheme in place, and who may have nothing to do with what Obama's saying, because after some people said this, Obama's office issued an immediate statement saying, we have not decided anything about this. So we don't know. But the point is, it's a huge risk, because if it happens, what you've seen being done is Guantanamo being rewrapped in a new legal wrapper, a Christmas paper, whatever it is, to make it more palatable to the courts, to Congress, et cetera. And you're really setting up a preventive detention scheme, but one that's going to have a court review. And to me, we've had federal courts here for 200 years that have tried people successfully. Well,
we've had this
what are we doing?
We had this discussion. The founding fathers had this discussion, and they had a whole procedure for bringing people to the bar and not keeping them stashed away somewhere without informing them of what the charges were against them and having them have a right to confront the evidence. What worries me is that if some kind of preventive detention scheme sneaks through, and you fast forward 2 years, and you have tremendous social battles, as I think we may have in this country, because of the economic disaster, a preventive detention scheme can be easily used to pick up leaders in the social justice movements. And if they put that thing down on us under the guise of fighting terrorism, we got a real problem in the future.
Michael, it's like anything we start like this. There's no limits. The argument goes, whatever you think about torturing one person, the argument becomes a slippery slope and you torture everybody. And once you start preventively detaining the so-called few people that they claim are really bad guys at Guantanamo, you will start preventively detaining a heck of a lot of people. So I think that the conservative judge who yelled out, tyrant, 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 has to be taken seriously for people who would want to really preventively detain or torture people.
Well, let's segue into the other conservative judge who we admire down in D.C., who let 5 of the 6 people go from Guantanamo, who had been there for 7 years, I think, and he said it's enough, and let 5 of them go. Tell that story, Michael.
Well, you know, this story, Michael, demonstrates the utter dishonesty of this administration and the dangers of using classified information and the dangers of not having a federal court review detention and the danger of not having habeas corpus, which took us three Supreme Court cases to win. And this is the Bosnian Muslim case. And there's six, but five were freed, and the sixth, who knows what's going to happen. They pulled, after we won the Supreme Court cases, they pulled a judge in the District of Columbia in the federal court. It's one of the more moderate conservative judges named Judge Leon.
Who was in the Federalist Society.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
So Judge Leon. And the question the judge had to face was, are these people, quote, enemy combatants, which is, of course, a form of preventive detention, but are these people enemy combatants, however that term is defined? And he defined it very broadly, almost anybody who opposes the United States in any way. Other judges have defined it less broadly. So they're finally, the lawyers, including the center is one of the counsel on this case, the lawyers went in for the argument and they said, show us the evidence that you can hold these people. And the government initially had claimed, and these guys have been held at Guantanamo for 6.5 years, and the claim by the government that they were picked up in Bosnia, actually, they're Algerian, but they had Bosnian citizenship or residence, and they were picked up there on the grounds that they were going to bomb the U.S. Embassy in Sarajevo. And what's interesting, the way they were picked up 6.5 years ago, is they'd been held in a Bosnian prison, and the Bosnian Human Rights Court had released them. And when they were walking out of the court, the U.S. swoops in, grabs them, sends them to Guantanamo ultimately, and they're in jail 6.5 years on the charge that has been in the press every day, that these people were conspiring to bomb the embassy at Sarajevo of the United States. On the eve of the hearing before Judge Leon, the U.S. dropped that charge. That's 6.5 years. They dropped that charge, and they say, we're not charging them with that anymore. We're charging them with possibly wanting to go to Afghanistan and fight on behalf of the Taliban. That becomes the charge, apart from whether there's anything illegal about that, it's another issue, but that's the charge against these guys. So they go before the judge, and the judge issues a 25-page ruling or so in which he looks at the classified evidence that the lawyers had seen as well, and he said, there's nothing here. There's nothing here. You just can't hold them for this. And he not only said that, he said, I don't want the Department of Justice or the CIA or the Pentagon appealing this case because there's nothing here. And he ordered the release of five of them, not immediately, but immediately as soon as they can find them a place. We'll see whether they appeal or not. The sixth one will be on appeal. He was supposedly facilitated in some way other people's travel to Afghanistan, but it's under a broad definition of enemy combatant that I think will not stick.
Can you imagine? They get picked up. They go from Algeria to Bosnia. They get out of prison. They get picked up as they're walking out and get sent over to Guantanamo for 6.5 years.
And they've been vindicated in Bosnia. So, yeah. So the importance of this case is, one is the thing we said when the center and I filed the first case on February 10th, 2002, to get people habeas corpus. Critical, critical protection is getting into court. It's not the only protection. It's not the final one, but it's critical to make that first step. The second thing you learn is how the government lies. Lie, lie, lie. The eve of trial, as soon as you get to a court, they drop the Bosnian case, the charges.
But that's been an MO for them.
That's right.
And the broad conclusion that I came to is that they weren't so much interested in justice for any one particular individual. They were interested in stirring up a whole fear of terrorism in this country.
Well, the other case is Padilla. Padilla came in as a so-called dirty bomber.
Yeah.
Remember, the U.S. citizen?
Yeah.
And then, of course, they eventually dropped that charge and charged him with some other kind of conspiracy. So that's the second lesson, is that they lie, and they are, as I agree with you, they're trying to exaggerate tremendously, just lie about what people have done. And the third one, of course, is the use of classified information to basically protect the fact that they have no evidence. So we're looking, really, in terms of these updates, you know, we're looking at closing Guantanamo, at hopefully not having a preventive detention scheme in national security courts, and eventually freeing the majority, if not all, of the Guantanamo detainees. In June of this year, an en-banc federal appeals court in Virginia ruled 5-4 that the Bush administration could subject Ali al-Mari to indefinite detention even though he was a resident of the United States. The court in the Fourth Circuit ruled that U.S. residents could be locked up indefinitely as enemy combatants even though they were never charged with a crime. Al-Mari is the only enemy combatant currently in detention and without charges in the United States. Our guest today, Jonathan Heifetz, says that at stake is whether the president can order the military to seize and detain indefinitely, without charge or trial, citizens or residents in the United States based on government claims that those citizens or residents are, quote, enemy combatants. Jonathan Heifetz is a staff attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Jonathan.
Hi, Michael. Thank you.
Jonathan, I know you're sort of on pins and needles. You're waiting to see what the Supreme Court does in a case that you argued twice in the Fourth Circuit. It's called the Almari case. Can you give a sense of what's the key issue in that case and why is it so important?
Yeah, I mean, the case involves Ali Almari, who's a citizen of Qatar, who was here legally in the United States and was arrested at his home, was later declared an enemy combatant, and has been imprisoned for more than 5 years in a military jail in South Carolina. And the issue in the case is whether the president can declare legal residents, including American citizens, because that's the implication, enemy combatants, and deprive them of a right to a trial and hold them indefinitely based on this idea that there's a global and never-ending, you know, war on terror.
Jonathan, when they took Almari in, what was the conditions under which they took him in? Did he get a lawyer right away? Where was he put?
Well, it's striking. I mean, the conditions under which, where he was taken from and where he was put in. As I mentioned, he was arrested at his home in Peoria in December of 2001, detained initially as a material witness in the 9/11 investigation, and then indicted for credit card fraud and making false statements 2 months later. And his case was about to go to trial in the Central District of Illinois in June of 2003. The judge had scheduled a trial date for the following month, and there was a suppression hearing even before that to throw out the whole case. Right when this happened, the government came to court one day and said, "Well, you know, we're cutting off these proceedings. The president has declared him an enemy combatant. We're taking him to military custody." Said the court, "You have nothing to do with this anymore. It's now a military matter." It was taken away in the middle of the night to a Navy brig in South Carolina and was held incommunicado for 16 months. No contact with the outside world, lawyers, family, anyone, even the Red Cross was refused access.
I didn't realize he had no lawyer even because, you know, normally, obviously, Guantanamo, they argue that, you know, they're aliens outside the United States, no lawyer. But I didn't realize they deprived him, even though U.S. sovereign territory have a right to a habeas corpus, but they said, no, I forgot that.
That's right. And that was their argument, actually, at the time in the Jose Padilla case, the American citizen, the only other person arrested in the U.S. and held as an enemy combatant. They were both at the same brig in South Carolina. They said, you don't have a right to a lawyer, which was done, you know, to facilitate interrogation tactics that bordered on, in some cases, amounted to torture, sleep deprivation, stress positions, threats of violence and death.
You lost this case in the Fourth Circuit in an on-bank decision. Why don't you tell us what the reasoning was why you lost and why you think this case is really so critical to liberty?
Well, I think the reasoning of it was a 5-4 decision for the full Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. We had actually initially won in the before a 3-judge panel, but then the full court reheard it. And the 5 judges who ruled against us just effectively said, well, that there must be this power to use the military to detain people in the United States to prevent terrorist attacks. And the president, you know, has to have this authority. And they found that it did not pose any kind of, risk for the Constitution. And, you know, we really strenuously disagree. I mean, this is the idea that the president can simply label someone an enemy and thereby deprive them of their basic right to a criminal trial and hold them, you know, not just temporarily, but potentially for life in some kind of perpetual conflict with Al-Qaeda, you know, runs against the most fundamental principles in the Constitution. It's a very dangerous power to allow any president to have. It has all kinds of terrible effects and harmful effects. It corrupts the whole criminal justice process. It can be used as a weapon against defendants to try to force them to plead guilty. It's been done before, and it just is a kind of anathema to the whole idea of a society under the rule of law, where, you know, individuals are presumed innocent, and if they're going to be deprived of their liberty, they have to be tried in a court. It just gives the executive way too much power.
Now, I know that you're waiting something significant, that you've appealed or asked for a grant of certiorari to the Supreme Court, and I think they are meeting on, when do they meet, Tuesday of this week?
The case was considered at the conference. There was no action taken on the case, so we don't, you know, there was no decision either way, whether to grant the case or to deny.
So what does that mean?
Well, we don't know. I mean, it could mean a number of things, and so they may just be, you know, including that they may take more time to considering it. I mean, obviously, we hope they take the case. They should take the case. It's a, you know, the idea of the president's power of the executive to use the military to seize people in the United States, including citizens, from their home or their places of work, certainly a question of surpassing importance, and one that's something the Supreme Court should resolve. And I should add, Michael, that, you know, we've now been through, you know, more than 7 years of these cases and these assertions of executive power. And so one of the principal issues, and obviously a crucial issue, is the right to habeas corpus, you know, the right to be able to get to court. And the Supreme Court's considered that basically three times now, you know, finally finding there's a constitutional right to habeas corpus for Guantanamo detainees and perhaps others as well. But the courts have not answered this other kind of fundamental basic question about, you know, who can be detained by the military, who is, as it were, a soldier and who is a civilian. All that's been said so far is that if someone who fights American troops on a battlefield with a gun, you know, someone, let's say, who picks up arms in Afghanistan, that person can be a soldier. But they have not grappled with what are really some of the most extreme cases that are at the heart of the so-called war on terror, picking people up far from a battlefield, including in this case, picking someone up, you know, in the United States at their home in Peoria, Illinois. And the courts have not really grappled with that question.
You know, I think that's absolutely crucial. I mean, it's taken us 7 years to essentially win the right of habeas, to even go into court and test the grounds that the government is supposedly giving for holding people. We've had no test really yet on what basis, they use the term maybe preventive detention, but really on what basis you can hold people without charges and without a trial. And I agree, El-Maarri really represents one of the heights of the government's power.
It seems to me that the government is asserting something that just undermines the whole juridical underpinnings of the Constitution. They're declaring a war not on a sovereign state, but a war on somebody they designate an enemy combatant, and then therefore give that person no rights whatsoever. And then to extend that to an American citizen. So now you've got the executive declaring law on citizens.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's right. It was, and that's exactly what Judge Motz wrote in an opinion that's, I think, one of the most powerful, you know, on these issues, you know, basically the danger that allowing the president to declare people, in fairness to the Court of Appeals, even the judges who ruled against us made clear that their ruling did apply to U.S. citizens, that it wasn't, and that's what the Supreme Court says, that combatant status is not citizenship-based, and that if, you know, if someone can be a combatant in the United States based on, you know, alleged terrorist association or activity, their citizenship is effectively irrelevant. And so this applies fully to U.S. citizens.
You're waiting to hear from the Supreme Court. They normally meet on a Tuesday, and they issue their order within, what, the next morning?
Yeah, I mean, there were orders issued Tuesday. There were two cases that they granted review on. They issued an order yesterday afternoon. There'll be, you know, presumably orders issued on Monday coming out of the conference. They may or may not take, you know, additional cases. It's possible that they may also hold the case for the next conference, which would be December 5th. I mean, there's just a number of possibilities that we just don't know.
Well, thank you very much for bringing us up to date on this, Jonathan, and good luck with the Supreme Court.
Yeah, thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
President-elect Barack Obama begins to build his administration, many are watching to see if the selections that he's making for officials are consistent with his discussion and rhetoric of change. One of the people who has followed this closely is Jeremy Scahill, author of the book Blackwater, and of a recent Alternet article called This Is Change, 20 Hawks, Clintonites, and Neocons to Watch for in Obama's White House. Scahill's article calls into question the list of recent appointees to the Obama team that includes some who have a history of supporting torture despite the calling by Obama for the end of torture and the shutting down of Guantanamo. Others are associated with the neoconservative Project for the New American Century.
Jeremy Scahill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you, Michael.
I want to recall for you that famous quote of Eugene V. Debs, the socialist and trade union leader at the turn of the century. He ran for president. As you know, he got almost 1 million votes. When dubious people said to him, why should we vote for you? It's a third party, not going to elect it. Debs responded in this fashion with the famous quote. He said, I'd rather vote for something I want and not get it than vote for something I don't want and get it.
Right.
And you've written this extremely good article in Alternet. We're going to put it up on our website at lawanddisorder.org. And your Alternet article says the following, and I wanted to pursue this thought. You talk about Obama's not just one person and he's the fruit of a tree with many roots. And then you say, Obama has a momentous opportunity to do what he repeatedly promised over the course of his campaign, bring actual change. But the more we learn about who Obama is considering for top positions in his administration, the more his inner circle resembles a staff reunion of President Bill Clinton's White House. Although Obama brought some progressives on board early in his campaign, his foreign policy team is now dominated by the hawkish old guard Democrats of the 1960s. So, Jeremy, I want to first talk to you about what we can expect foreign policy-wise with this team and then go over to domestic. But with respect to foreign policy and a team dominated by these recycled Clintonites, including Hillary Clinton herself, talk a little bit about what Clinton's foreign policy was like and projected into the present, will you?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, Bill Clinton's foreign policy in the 1990s really boiled down to a 1-2 punch from the hidden hand of free market capitalism, defense of what they call U.S. interests, and then the iron fist of U.S. militarism. While there's a tendency now, particularly among many Democrats, to look at the Clinton years as sort of glory years, the reality is that this guy, Bill Clinton, was essentially one of the greatest Republican presidents of all time, and really a figure that shows that when it comes to foreign policy in particular, we don't have two parties in this country. We have one party, a corporate war party. You know, remember, Bill Clinton took office and then almost immediately bombed Iraq over that alleged plot of Saddam Hussein to assassinate George H.W. Bush, which was a very dubious allegation at the time. He rained missiles down on Iraq almost immediately upon taking office. He dismantled Yugoslavia. He bombed Yugoslavia in 1999 with no U.N. authorization. He pushed through NAFTA and GATT, which hurt and devastated workers in this country, and then targeted developing economies around the world, particularly in the Western Hemisphere. He launched airstrikes against Sudan and Afghanistan, escalated and militarized the so-called war on drugs, particularly in Latin America, which is really a counterinsurgency war. And his neoliberal economic policies ultimately sparked a global rebellion that was not covered in much of the world's press, but was very, very real. And what I think is most important to understand about Clinton's time in office during the 1990s is that his policies laid the groundwork for some of the most repressive and violent policies of the Bush era on Iraq, on civil liberties, on economic policy, on financial and fiscal policy. We're talking about a continuity of government that runs from Bush Sr. through Clinton to George W. Bush. And unfortunately, Obama is taking these same individuals who were part of that bipartisan war machine and putting them back in prominent positions. It began with his selection of Joe Biden as his running mate, a hawkish man who was a passionate supporter of many of Bush's most repressive policies. And now with the talk of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, Rahm Emanuel as Chief of Staff, potentially keeping on, it looks like now, Robert Gates as Defense Secretary. This was a man, Robert Gates, who was George H.W. Bush's director of Central Intelligence. And Michael, I know you were raising a ruckus during that period. Remember what was happening during George H.W. Bush's time in office. You had the rampaging of Central America. You had all sorts of dirty, violent tricks around the world unfolding. And Gates now is going to be kept on as Obama's defense secretary. What message does that send, not only to the anti-war people who were a large part of Obama's base, but to the rest of the world who hears a man saying, we're going to change the way Washington's foreign policy is run? It's looking very, very dark right now.
Well, I hope that the message is this, or at least that people eventually figure out this. I remember Ronald Reagan's speechwriter saying that the Democratic Party is the capitalist second favorite party. And I think the message that's going to come out now is that they've now become the first favorite party, and that there's a continuity in their foreign policy that goes all the way back to the 80s. And I think we're going to see that also in their domestic economic policy. So let me come stateside now and ask you what you see in terms of the appointments for domestic policy.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's very telling that when Obama announced his economic team and some of the other appointments recently, that the praise that poured in from senior Republicans for Obama's selections was incredible. You know, you had Mitch McConnell, who is a horrible person, who's one of the top Senate Republicans. He said the new administration is off to a good start. James Baker, the former Secretary of State, the man who led the theft of the 2000 election, the sort of godfather or kingpin of the Republican movement right now, he said, I see them as being sort of center-right of the Democratic Party. And then we had David Brooks, a conservative New York Times columnist. And Michael, I love this quote. He said that this is superb. The best of the Washington insiders. This will be a valedictocracy, ruled by those who graduate first in their high school classes. You know, Henry Kissinger saying it's outstanding. I mean, the fact that these individuals are praising Obama gives us a sense of what to expect from his economic team. You know, obviously, you know, Larry Summers and Geithner heading up the economic team sends a clear message to Wall Street that corporate interests are going to remain supreme over the interests of ordinary working folks in this country. It's a total contradiction of Obama's campaign pledge to speak up for the middle class, to talk for the little people. I mean, the reality is that he's putting together a team of people who were part of the problem and cannot be expected to dig us out of this situation. The only situation that Obama's economic team is going to dig us out of is the problem for corporations. Ordinary people are going to suffer tremendously for years to come, and a large part of it is because Obama has unfortunately chosen to maintain the status quo. The one last thing I'll say, Michael, on this is that Naomi Klein, my good friend who wrote The Shock Doctrine and has been an incredible voice of reason and sanity in this current economic situation, you know, she was saying for months leading up to this election that Barack Obama does not represent radical change. John McCain would have represented radical change. Barack Obama represents the status quo. And unfortunately, the status quo is not good for people who roll up their sleeves and go to work every day, or who are the suffering poor of this country.
Robert Rubin was Clinton's guy economically, right. And then he went over to Citibank. His main protege just got appointed head of the Treasury. What's the first thing he did? He announced that they're going to bail out Citibank. This is an extension of this corporate giveaway that started off with neoliberalism, with privatization, free markets, and using the iron fist of the military in there to get them opened up. And it seems to me that that's what's going to be continuing domestically and foreign-wise.
Well, and then, Michael, we also have, with the appointment of Eric Holder, you know, as the Attorney General, many of the interests that you guys have, that both Michael Ratner and Michael Smith, that you guys have in terms of who's the Attorney General regarding Bush war crimes, regarding Guantanamo, regarding the Patriot Act, regarding civil liberties, Eric Holder is definitely going to be an improvement on anyone that Bush had over the past 8 years at the Justice Department. But let's remember that Holder has worked with the Chiquita Banana Company, one of the most vicious violators of human rights in Latin America, and cut his teeth on a national stage at Janet Reno's Justice Department, which was the subject of litigation from the Center for Constitutional Rights that was responsible for the massacre at Waco, the Elian Gonzalez case, implementing these repressive policies on civil dissenters in this country. I mean, I think it's incredibly important that we put tremendous pressure on the Justice Department under the Obama administration to actually seek out justice. We need to have a truth and reconciliation movement that puts the emphasis on truth. Unfortunately, I think we're only going to have the reconciliation part of it with the Obama administration, and that's a really big crisis.
Our position is less reconciliation and more prosecution.
Right. Right. Well, that's the truth end of it. That's why we need a truth commission that actually has teeth, subpoena power, and is going to look seriously at locking people up for the crimes that they've committed over the past 8 years.
Hey, Jeremy, you know, the only thing is I don't love the word truth commission, even from someone who I love like you, because it really implies that there's, first, there's a truth that's unknown, and secondly, it gives an indication there might not be prosecutions. So what you want is a criminal investigation commission or a commission of inquiry at the lowest. At the best, you want a special prosecutor who just goes after these guys. There was an article by Jack Goldsmith in the Washington Post, an editorial saying there shouldn't even be an investigation, there should be no prosecution, that it'll hurt the national security of the United States, et cetera, et cetera. That's his argument, that people be afraid to take, you know, strong positions in DOJ or CIA, which is, of course, just complete BS to protect all the guys. I mean, my position is absolutely there has to be prosecutions in this case.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, and it's semantics here. I mean, what I think we're really saying is that we need to have all of these individuals held accountable under a system that actually takes them to task and treats them as the criminals that they've shown themselves to be. The problem with this, though, and I've talked to people on Capitol Hill about it, is that if the Obama administration starts going after them, they're going to open themselves up to investigations of Democratic complicity, Democrats complicity in this, and that's the main reason they're not going to do it. And that shows the spineless nature of this two-party system. The fact is that you had many top Democrats who not only sort of voted the wrong way, or they now say in some cases on Iraq, but were actually promoting lies about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, voting for the Patriot Act, supporting the illegal, unlawful imprisonment of people at Guantanamo. The CIA's extraordinary rendition program was started under Bill Clinton's administration. You know, Bill Clinton was the one who allowed Blackwater to start pushing its services to the federal government. So if we're going to have that kind of a prosecution or an investigation that we need, that you're talking about, Michael, it's going to really put a lot of Democrats out in an unfavorable light. I think it's important to investigate all of them. That, though, is the reason we're not going to see Obama going after these guys. It will take the Democrats to task and the Republicans.
No, I think that's right. Even Goldsmith in his article tries to bring that up and say, you know, if you look into the rendition program, what are you looking at? You're looking at Clinton here.
Right.
So, and of course, you're talking about people like Pelosi and Jane Harman, who are on the Intelligence Committee and knew about waterboarding and stuff like that. And you're talking about taking down people, you know, even so-called respectable Republicans like Powell. So-called.
And including people in Obama's inner circle right now. I mean, you look at Brennan, you know, who now has taken himself out of the running, John Brennan, taken himself out of the running for CIA director. This was a guy who was a passionate supporter of some of the most horrifying torture policies of the Bush administration. He tries to now rebrand himself and say he spoke out against waterboarding. I mean, look, many Republicans started to speak out against waterboarding. Waterboarding is one in a sea of torture tactics that the United States used, and Brennan has been a supporter of several of the worst of those. The idea that Obama keeps him on board as one of the people who's going to decide who runs the intelligence apparatus in this country, I think is shameful.
No, I agree with you. I thought the Brennan issue was shameful. You know, but Brennan not only was on videotape essentially supporting rendition and enhanced interrogation techniques, but also he was the key assistant to Tenet when he was head of the CIA. And the single worst abuses, I think, in this entire so-called torture scandal were the secret CIA sites run by the CIA.
Right.
And this guy's the chief assistant. And I think what was going on here is you can imagine, assuming the Democrats had any backbone at all, would they ask him at a confirmation hearing, what was your role? Did you know about the secret sites? Did you know how they put people in coffins, how they waterboarded them, et cetera? And what did you do about it?
Right.
And the other thing is the transition team on intelligence with Brennan had this other woman, Jamie Masick, I think is her name.
Yeah.
And she was the one who helped craft Colin Powell's line speech to the UN that paved the way for the attack on Iraq.
I mean, oh, yeah, she and Brennan are the two people running the show at the Obama camp working on who's going to run intelligence. She wasn't just the person who developed intelligence for you know, Colin Powell's fraudulent speech. She's the CIA official that has been pinpointed as the top one who was sidelining intelligence that would have debunked the lies being put forward by Cheney and Bush about a mushroom cloud scenario, and then pushing the intelligence that was politicized intelligence that would have enabled the march on Iraq, which happened, the bombing of Iraq. So she was someone who didn't just sort of look the other way or sort of inserted something that turned out to be false. She was directly complicit in quashing evidence that would have contradicted the dominant line of the day. These are the two people.
I know.
I mean, it's like Orwellian. that you vote for change and you get torture and skewed intelligence.
You wrote this excellent article. We're going to put it up on our website, lawanddisorder.org. It's called "This Is Change: Obama's Hawks, Neocons, and Clintonites." It's on Alternet, and it's a 12-page study, really, of the backgrounds of all the various people that Obama has put on the team. The bloom is going to start coming off the rose. It's coming off probably slower than we'd hope because of Obama's great popularity. He's really a rock star. But I think the policies that you've set forth, given these people's backgrounds, are going to take that bloom off the rose. And then what do you say to people? What did you say to people when you weren't an avid Obama supporter during the campaign? What do you say to them now? What do we do in the future? How do we protect ourselves? What's your thinking on that?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, one of the things that I think, you know, any of us who travels around the country and we're talking to people on a regular basis, you know, you talk to a wide variety of people. Most of the people that would come to my events, and I spend about one out of every 3 days on the road for the past 2 years, you know, a lot of them were anti-war people who were either, you know, voting for Obama and understanding what they were doing, or they were people that were really torn between going for Nader or McKinney or voting third party. And I think that a lot of people were afraid that if McCain and Palin won, there was going to be open fascism in this country, and that there were going to be infinitely greater chances of Iran being attacked and other countries being attacked. Now, I understand that fear that many people have. I wasn't so much interested in having a debate with people on that issue as much as saying, what are you going to do, you know, the day after the election and moving forward? Because the reality is that Obama is not going to end the occupation of Iraq. He is going to escalate the war in Afghanistan. He's not going to be great at all on holding the Bush officials accountable, as we've discussed before, for these crimes. So we need to talk about building a movement in this country that is independent of electoral politics. I'm not saying ignore electoral politics, but I think we need to start building coalitions across this country that are issue-based organizing cells in this country to take on these issues. Ultimately, I see the premier issue of our time, radical privatization. You know, our entire life is being privatized in this country. The corporations are in total control. And so I think we need to start really taking the fight directly to these corporations. It's a very bleak situation right now. Yes, it's good that John McCain and Sarah Palin are not in power in this country, but Obama is not a saint. He's not a messiah. He is a center Democrat who is very closely tied to the Democratic policy elite. You know, the emperor is going to be shown to have no clothes eventually. It may take a year or 2 years, but I think those of us who've been speaking out about this will once again be vindicated, as we were, and both of you were, in the 90s with Bill Clinton. But that's going to be a tough, tough road that we have ahead of us. I get tremendous hate mail now. My days are over as being sort of popular in the liberal blogosphere. When you take public in company, it's like, oh, we'll welcome you to come and speak at our events. Now I'm just, you know, my inbox is just inundated with hate mail and, you know, people telling me to move back to Russia. I'm like, well, Russia? What are you talking? Is this the 80s?
Jeremy Scahill, we've got history on our side. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you guys very much for what you're doing. I mean, I just want to say one thing about the two of you and about this program. I've said across this country repeatedly, and I've been saying it recently, you know, until I'm blue in the face, that had it not been for human rights lawyers, for the people at the Center for Constitutional Rights, God help us for what would have happened worse in this country over these past 8 years. My total faith to hold these individuals accountable for their crimes that they've committed over the past 8 years is in the work that people like both of you do on a daily basis in this country, because you are the real freedom fighters. You guys are the ones who are going to hold them accountable when no one else will have the political backbone to do it. And my hope, Michael Ratner, is that the Center for Constitutional Rights puts the fear of God into Dick Cheney and George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld if they ever step foot into Europe.
You know, Jeremy, I really appreciate that. And we're obviously trying really hard. I mean, the number of articles now coming out to defend the policies and to say there shouldn't be prosecution means to me they're frightened, these guys. These guys are frightened. And if they're not going to do it here, we're going to do it abroad. And hopefully, Jeremy, in the end, when they award the next freedom medals from the president, instead of giving them to George Tenet like they did after 100 people were tortured in secret CIA sites, they'll give them to the guy who exposed Blackwater and the people who exposed Guantanamo. So, Jeremy, thanks to our next freedom medal, Jeremy.
Not only that, we're going to nominate you for a MacArthur.
All right, I hope you edit this out of the interview.
Yeah, right.
You take it easy. Thank you.
Take care, you guys.
Yeah, bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.